Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome. This is Way of the Dreamer. This is a show where we affirm the power of dreams, coincidence, and imagination, which are too frequently dissed and sidelined in our lives. I'm very happy to have Roger Kamenetz as my guest today. You will know him, perhaps, from some of his books. The Jew and the Lotus was very popular, very important book about his auditing a dialogue between rabbis and the Dalai Lama. The History of Last Night's Dreams is a very good book about dreaming and how he approaches it and his practice and teaching. And he has a book coming out, which unfortunately we cannot buy today because we should. It's called Seeing into the Life of Things, a phrase borrowed from Wordsworth, which already evokes his love of poetry, including the poet Wordsworth. Roger is a poet. He was for a long time professor of both English and religious studies at Louisiana State University. And I must say that when I read him, I smell and see the colors of New Orleans on every other page, wherever he happens to be. I mean, he brings it wonderfully alive. Seeing into the Life of Things is coming up, and we'll talk about that today. Let me just say, by way of further introduction, that where I find my mind harmonizing most closely to Roger's is when he tells us, in words like this, these are mine, but he says things like this, that we need to stop interpreting dreams according to our waking assumptions and let our dreams interpret life. I mean, this is exactly right from my point of view, because dreaming takes us to a deeper world, a deeper place. It is a real world. And when it comes to harvesting the gifts of our dreams, we need to do much better than analyze. We need to let the raw power, the raw power of the dream image come through. And Roger has very creative ways of doing that. One more thing by way of introduction. Roger isn't shy about talking about his own dreams and his own encounters in his books, and this is essential because I tell you, we don't want to hear about dreams from someone who doesn't do a lot of it themselves and dares to report and share the stories. My favorite quote from one of Roger's dreams in the new book, Seeing into the Life of Things, is from a beautiful young woman who's driving a truck in a separate compartment from him, and she says to him in his dream, quote, "I don't think you should be afraid to make everything you say a prayer." And I think you're acting on that, Roger. Is that correct?
I'm trying, Robert, and let me say thank you so much for the generous and concise and so well articulated introduction. It's a rare thing these days, but thank you. Yes, I do. I think we all speak a lot. We say a lot of words, but we rarely utter words. You know, we rarely have words that come up from within us from a deeper place. And I believe the idea of prayer is, you know, is that someone is listening. So if we begin to think that everything we say might possibly become a prayer, perhaps we would speak differently. I have to say that, like all dream advice, it's so inspiring, but then, of course, in the day-to-day, it's challenging to live it, isn't it?
What do you do first thing when you return from a dream, whether the dream is a sleep dream or a hypnopompic state or something in that drifty liminal state, or indeed from a meditation? What's the first thing you do? I mean, you might need to grab a coffee or go to the restroom, but what is the first basic thing you do with your body and your mind in your life?
Well, I've been writing down my dreams for a long time, for at least 20 years. And I think that practice has changed a bit, but in the beginning I felt so urgent about it, and in those days I would run to my laptop, type the dream down as best as I could remember it, and then try to go back to sleep. I use a slightly different technology now, but before I do that, or especially if I'm trying to recover a dream, I just try to lie still in that transitional state. I call it the perfume of the dream. I'm still in that dream mind state, even though I'm partly awake. And I just try to relish the dream and feel the images, because those are, these, for me, the essential moments, those moments where we encounter an image either of a thing or a living being. And maybe the distinction isn't as real as we think between those two. And just relish or savor those images. And then I try to write them down.
Right. Well, I love you using the sensory language of relish and savor, but you gave me a frisson even earlier when you talked about the perfume. You probably noticed, but a popular title for a dream guide, the kind of dream book that we don't actually want to use in the Islamic tradition, is The Perfume of Dreams. It comes up again and again as a title.
Wow.
You go to the Ottoman period. The books that are supposedly based on Abu Sirin, who probably didn't even write a dream book himself, but whose name was used again and again. You'll find that a favorite title for dream books, where you look up the meaning of something, is The Perfume of Dreams. So you put us in touch with an ancient practice and understanding. And I want to just circle back to the idea of prayer for a moment. When I reopened Seeing Into the Life of Things, your forthcoming book, this morning before this conversation, I opened it in the way of such things at your account of the morning blessing prayer, the Hebrew prayer recited on waking from sleep, giving thanks for the soul being returned to the body. And I just found this delicious, because I've been studying and now writing even more about what I call the indigenous and archaic monomyth, which is that the soul, or something we might call soul, travels beyond the body in sleep, in dreams, and returns. And there it is, implied, if not stated openly. It seems to me to be stated openly in the morning blessing, right? Thank you for letting my soul come back to my body.
Absolutely. And that particular prayer formulation, which touches base with some biblical text, but was formulated by someone influenced by Jewish mysticism or Kabbalah, where... And if you look into the Zohar, which is the Book of Splendor, a great Kabbalistic masterpiece that was written in Spain in the year 1300, I believe, the theory of the dream is definitely that the soul leaves the body and travels up through a storm of demons who are trying to confuse us, and reaches a higher level, depending on what kind of work we've done on our soul during our lives, receives something, some spark of light or inspiration, then has to descend back down to the same crowd of demons who try to confuse us, and then enters the body. So, this is one more indigenous theory of the dream, and it probably, for me also, Robert, speaks to how we feel about sleep. You know, the rabbis say that a dream is 1/60th prophecy, and that sleep is 1/60th death. In other words, if we want to understand what it's like to have a prophetic inspiration, we can look at the dream. And if we want to understand what it's like to die, we can look at sleep. And so I think the two are closely related. And the feeling of gratitude is proportionate to the feeling of risk or terror. If we take for granted, oh, I go to sleep at night and I'm going to wake up in the morning, okay, then we might take the next day for granted. But if we truly understand that we might not make it back, perhaps we have more gratitude to bring into our day, and that's...
This is very good stuff, Roger. Thank you. You're taking us right back into the primal understanding of what goes on with dreams and what happens to the soul, or one of the souls, or one of the aspects of the soul. Again, in preparation, I was revisiting some notes that I made from Jewish sources, particularly in the 17th century, that sort of period. I was rereading the autobiography of Rabbi Leon Modena, an Italian would say Modena, Modena, an American would probably say, who was a Jewish intellectual and rabbi in Venice, in the ghetto, in the 17th century, and he wasn't sure what was going to happen after death until he met his father. I'll circle back to this in a moment. He saw his father in a dream, according to his memoir, a month after his death. And he recalled that his father had talked to him about the fate of the soul after death and had quoted a Sephardic friend saying on his deathbed, "Now I will know what a soul is." So, inspired by the memory inside his dream, Rabbi Modena asks his father, "Tell me, please, honored scholar, what is the state of your soul? And what is it like for you in that world?" His father says, "I eat well and drink well here." And the rabbi is shocked and incredulous. He says, "How can this be? You know, the sages of blessed memory state the world to come. There's no eating and drinking." And his father says, "He should get the fool who said this to read some scripture to the part where the righteous sit and enjoy and behold God and eat and drink." So I was looking at that, Roger, while getting ready for you, and thinking, oh, it's delightful, isn't it? But it's also very just so, very matter-of-fact. You know, we meet the dead in our dreams, and we don't have to fumble around for euphemisms to describe what's going on. We meet the dead because the soul survives, and our soul is traveling, and we get together. Is that close to your understanding of these things?
I think, of course, I don't know, so... But I believe that one thing that this captures is just how significant and important our dreams of the dead are and the feelings that we have in those encounters. And, yes, the intelligence we receive in those encounters is to be cherished and taken very seriously. I want to say two stories. One, first of all, thank you for this story and also for the information about the Islamic tradition. It's so important to bring that in. I thank you for that. So one story that your story reminded me of is that in the Talmud, there was a student who was quite concerned about what death was, just like in the story you're telling, and made his teacher promise to appear to him after death in a dream. So his teacher did appear, and he asked him, "Well, what is death like, teacher?" And the teacher said, "It's like removing the hair from the milk, or removing a hair from the milk."
Right. Yeah.
You probably know that one.
Yes. But it always reminds me of one from a completely different tradition. I'm going to fumble the details, but it's about how it's just as easy as the skin coming off a mango or a banana something like that. I think the skin coming off a mango is what it is, and I think it comes from one of those warm places where mangoes grow in abundance. I'll have to find it now. Roger, before we go any further, I have to loop back from my earlier statement about meeting the soul of the dead, etc., because your books contain many moving and very specific accounts of dream encounters with the departed, including Rev Zalman, yes, including your own parents and so on. And they're very interesting stories. I think I just have to ask you directly, do you think you were meeting with the individual spirits of those people, or do you look at it a different way?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that it's a puzzle in a certain way. There's a fight in me between the earthbound constricted consciousness and the larger consciousness of imagination. But I'll say it this way. When Reb Zalman died, he told me, and he sent a message to me ahead of time, what a remarkable thing for him to do, saying that he would do his best to stay in touch, and that I knew he meant through my dreams, and he has done that. And every teaching he's given me and every appearance he's made, and quite often he's very stern with me, Robert. He's rebuking of my lack of faith, I guess. I take it very, very seriously and very, very real. So it's definitely real. Maybe I'm not quite as willing to say that that's the full nature of the reality. It's the reality I know through my experiences in dreams, and I'll put it that way. And I take it as very real and very important, because I think we both agree the imagination is real, and what takes place in imagination is serious and real, and in some ways, definitely a much more important experience than our poor reason.
Right. Well, I think we both agree that we can only know about these things firsthand, and that however many books we read, and you and I are both bookish people who love to read many sources, however many books we read, however much study we make, we require direct revelation. We require firsthand experience. And this is one of the areas where it's particularly essential. If I might just briefly say this. When my father died back in 1987, he started appearing to me in dreams with specific information for members of the family to which I had no ordinary access. And I have no, for example, information that enabled my mother to find a protective and kindly environment for the last years of her life, which involved directions to a realtor I'd never heard about and so on. Very specific stuff. So I understood, and she understood, even though she'd been reluctant to talk about dreams or relations with the departed prior to this, we had no doubt that Dad was coming through. And then after that, he started showing me his transitions on the other side. And we hadn't been close much of our lives. We were never at odds, really, but we came together a bit before his death. And after his death, he became a kind of counselor, if you like, a member of my inner board of directors, as you would put it in your new book. And then a moment came when he said to me, having revealed all sorts of things to which I had no ordinary access, involving many lives and many situations, he basically said he'd made his choice about what he was going to do now, and he would not be seeing me the same way anymore. Fine. Gone. Then, many years later, I am drifting in that hypnopompic state, in that liminal space, that space when you smell the perfume of dreams. And I'm up on a high rooftop, which is a place I like to be in moments of vision. And I see a man there, and I recognize my father looking as he did when he was 30, and I'm shocked, not by the way he looks or by the fact that he's dead but alive. I know he's alive. But he said he was going away. And suddenly, as soon as I recognize him, I'm right up in front of him. He puts his finger on my upper lip, and he says, go to a doctor and get that checked out. So I call a dermatologist. When I get out of bed, that's my first action. And the dermatologist looks, and he says it's basal cell carcinoma. It's not too serious, so it's an awkward place. You have it taken care of. And after the surgery and all of that, I raised a glass of single malt whiskey. My father was a Scottish soldier, and I said, thanks, Dad. Now, I have no doubt that the early encounters were with the individual spirit of my father. At this point, later on, did he succeed in coming back, or was a messenger sent, you know, under a friendly mask? I don't actually know, but I know the results are incredibly positive because I've been ignoring what I thought was just a scratch on a mole, and there you are.
Well, that's remarkable, and it certainly, what's to say? It's a truth. It's your truth, and also I've had similar, nothing like that, but something similar. Can I tell it to you?
I have to say this, Roger. You don't use the way stories that I do. I mean, I understand what you mean when you're dismissive of the word story, but I love stories. And, I'm partly a Celt. And they say in Ireland, you don't get in without a story. You can't come in without a story. So I want to hear your story. And if you don't mind, I'm going to call it a story.
No, I don't. It's a very difficult distinction. Remember, my wife is a fiction writer, Moira Crone, I definitely respect story, but I think what I'm distinguishing is the weak and automatic story making / lying of the ego that wants to preserve itself above all costs. Whereas the story that comes from the imagination that touches into myth is a true myth, a deepest way.
I absolutely, absolutely understand, respect, and concord with your distinction. It's just that in your writing, it's the only thing that I would complain about. You use the word story in a way that to me is unclear. I mean, it's clear to me in the sense I know that's the kind of story that you want us to put on one side, the crust of that kind of story from, you know, the true imagination, what it wants to bring through. But in the process, you know, you don't allow for the big story, the authentic story. We're going to have to wait until after the break to hear the story you're about to tell. I'm very eager to hear it. And although Roger and I might use the word story very differently, I think he's about to deliver a really good one, as he has done in many of his books and lectures over the years. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. Our wonderful guest is Roger Kamenetz, poet, storyteller, dreamer, teacher. We'll hear more from him in a moment.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of the act of dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. This is Robert Moss. Hop over to my website, mossdreams.com. By the way, it's almost the last person amongst all my acquaintance. I recently created a Substack account, and I'm using it for new writing. In fact, the last couple of days, I've used it for pieces that I've written immediately from my dreams the night before, like today, like yesterday. So if you have not subscribed to my Substack account, it's free for now. Go and do it. Here's Roger Kamenetz, what a wonderful guest, and he's written books that you want to read, The History of Last Night's Dreams, and the new one, Seeing into the Life of Things, and he's about to tell us a story. Over to you, Roger.
Thank you, Robert. So many stories, really, but this one is special, I think. My father died, So I should back up and say I wrote an autobiographical book called Terra Inferma, a memoir of my mother's life and mine. And when the book came out, it was a very intimate story about my life with my mother, but obviously it had implications for my family. And I asked my father what he thought of the book, and he said, quote, "It didn't bother me a bit," which was his way of saying it bothered him a lot. Many years later, after he died, my stepmother had an accident and fell, and I had a dream about it, and it was very clear from the dream that I needed to go down there and see her, and so I did. And when I got there, I found this letter that my father had written to me and never sent when I had written Terra Infirma. And the letter revealed that many of the things that I revealed about my mother, he had no idea about. I mean, they'd been married for 25 years, and he didn't know anything about her childhood, her shame about her childhood, and she was a foster child. A lot of things that she had concealed from him and from all of us her whole life. And it was such a moving thing, Robert, to read this letter, and I felt that the dream had sent me there to find this letter from him. Mm. So maybe it's a bit attenuated, but you get the picture, I think, that the dream led me
very
to discover this letter. Yeah.
It's very moving. And one thing that dreams do is they do drive us to sources. I mean, I guess because I'm so bookish, at least as bookish as you, my dreams are forever sending me to the library, you know, to look up some obscure document, or when I find it doesn't exist in this reality yet, to write it myself. I mean, I had to do that recently. I had to write a document which I had in the dream, which I'd written in the dream, but which I had not composed in this life. Actually, I posted my first version of that on Substack today.
Wonderful. Well, I look forward to reading that.
Even though the dream world is an independent reality, I mean, a real life world, arguably, as seen in indigenous cultures and as seen by some of us active dreamers today, no less real than ordinary life. Often our activities there do resemble our activities in ordinary life because some fundamental aspects of our personality or our daemonion, perhaps, operate. So I read and write and edit as much or even more in dreams as I do in regular life. And when we hear the kind of sleep researcher you and I both know who says, oh, you can't read in your dreams, I say, nonsense. What's the matter with your dream life? Do you read in ordinary life? Maybe your dream self is as illiterate as your waking self. I mean, I'm just astonished. When I look at the history of dreaming, and I look at interesting characters like Wolfgang Pauli, for example, the quantum physicist, associate of Jung, who helped develop synchronicity theory, Pauli was constantly reading things in his dreams, and he wrote them down. Actually, I wrote a piece on Pauli's reading, his dream reading list. So there we are. Mm. There's so much to talk to you about, and you're such a good speaker too, Roger. I just want to go to a beautiful image that is with me right now from the new book, Seeing Into the Life of the World. It's when you pause in the saccade or the saccade, you pause from the saccade to look at a little blue wildflower glowing out of the sidewalk in New Orleans. Take us there. Just give us the scene and talk to us about what is going on in your imagination and your perception in that moment.
So, yes, I'm walking down the street, and, I almost think it might be better to read what I wrote. What do you think? Is that okay?
That's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
I've been reading you. Let's hear you in your own voice.
All right. Let me see if I can find it. A little bit of that, anyway. So I spot this flower as I'm walking down my street. We call it Burgundy Street in New Orleans, although most would say Burgundy. A few dogs and their walkers brushed past me on the narrow brick sidewalk as I crouched and then knelt for a closer look. Someone in another era might have thought I was praying. I had moved deep into my inner world, but I was not meditating. That is, I was not focused on my breath, thoughts, or body. I was, to be precise, contemplating, looking at an image and feeling into it, contemplating a radiant blue, or better, a blue radiance. I felt mysterious color enter me, and because I could not immediately offer a better name than blue, the unnamed sensation seemed even more wonderfully unbounded. This blue carried a great brightness into my heart. It made me feel a special joy. I was soaking in the color. If now I had to give this blue a more precise name, it would not be turquoise or aquamarine, not navy or cornflower blue. I think the best name would be azure, a hopelessly poetic name, but accurate for this flower. The feeling of my sidewalk flower was also celestial. So I'll stop there. But you know, in another part of... Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, go on, please.
No, I want to hear your... more important for me to hear what you had to say.
Well, I want you to talk... I really resonated, or let's say I palpated, I stirred with this description. In its context, you're talking about how we use perception or like perception, how we miss great swathes of what we might envision or see or imagine because of this saccade or saccade on Burgundy Street or Burgundy Street. And this is a moment, I don't really use the word in the book, but it's a moment of darshan, isn't it? It's a moment of seeing through things, to things. And there's the physical object in its beauty, and you want the name. And yet in this moment of seeing, of deep seeing, you're entering a world of imaginal possibilities. So something stirred alive in the simplicity of it, the blue flower on Burgundy Street. Yes, I would have said Burgundy, and thank you for correcting me. And because you took me there with the whole ambience. I mean, I'm smelling what Mufalita's Sazerac's puke from last night's drunks, and I'm hearing the jazz, I'm hearing the music. I mean, you're New Orleans, you're New Orleans. But it's darshan, isn't it? It's seeing in a deep sense. Is that a way of looking at it?
I think it's darshan. I think it's kensho, seeing nature and seeing self-nature. It's a holy encounter, isn't it? A sacred encounter. But we ourselves must get away from this ordinary practical state of mind and stop time a little bit and open ourselves to these experiences. And that's part of what I'm trying to explain or explore in this book and teach, I hope, to others in a way that helps them learn how to do this as well in their daily lives. We can see the world as infinite, as Blake says, but we have to stop and look and feel and listen and use our senses. And unfortunately, my mind, I won't speak to others, but my mind is so full of abstractions and noise and news that I sometimes and often forget to do that.
Right. Well, you're guiding us on a better path here, Roger. We're talking to Roger Kamenetz. We'll be back for more. This is Way of the Dream with Robert Noss. We're going to take a short break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. mossdreams.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com. Get your personal dream symbols and discover the ones you dream about in Linda McKenzie's Symbols of You, a new book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, and more.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
This is Robert Noss. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. I'm having the best time with Roger Kamenetz. We're just discussing a blue wildflower on a sidewalk on Burgundy Street. I'm getting that in the New Orleans way. We actually talked about, we used some Eastern terms for a moment, like darshan. And since we went Eastern, Roger, I want to mention that one of the fascinating moments in your new book, Seeing Into the Life of Things, is when you talk about your inner council of directors, your inner board of directors, and among them sits the 17th century Japanese haiku master, Basho. I feel I'm one of his students. So let's talk about the inner board of directors. It's a memorable phrase. And let's talk about the kind of guides and guidance that is available in dreaming in this way and your experience of it.
Well, William Blake has been on there. I think the late 18th century Hasidic founder and master of the known as the Baal Shem Tov, the master of the good name.
Right.
I suppose Wordsworth I've added. I think I say in the book that was a new... Yeats is on there.
I was pleased and delighted. I don't think I've seen Wordsworth quoted so well or celebrated with such original passion for a long time. I know your love of Wordsworth is really striking. And it really does lend some, great tones to the book.
Thank you. It was a late romance, I'll say this. A young poet friend, so to speak, turned me on to Wordsworth. I'd always ignored him. I preferred Blake as a young person. And I just kind of skipped over him, and I don't want to say my critiques of him, they really don't matter, but two things I think that are so valuable and I try to enlist in this book. One is that he did have this experience of what Einstein called cosmic consciousness, or this sense of that all is one, and we can have it in waking life, as he did, and we can also have it in our dreams. And really, my dreams, and this is very important, I think, my dreams have guided me to these experiences in which the ego disappears completely, and there is only the one. It's all one. And I think this sense that the events in our life, and I think we've been circling around this in different ways, are not random, but are secretly connected and in some mysterious way intended. I'm thinking of the story of your lip, for one thing, but also the story about my father's letter. And it's all... Wordsworth is there, and not only is he there, but because he was such an historian of his own consciousness, and really a pioneer historian of consciousness in his great book, The Prelude, he can tell us how he got there, how his imagination developed. And this is such a valuable text for us.
And he tells us, as you remind us about the training of memory, spectacles and sounds to which I often would repair and thence would drink as at a fountain. And you borrow the rather prosaic phrase, spots in time, from Wordsworth, to talk about choosing the moments of life, the memories to which you give attention, so that you can drink from a fountain and not choosing the wrong ones. There's actually an image from West Africa that conveys that part of the deal very well, the Sankofa. Sankofa is shown as a bird with its head turned around looking backwards. And the message, sometimes there's an egg involved, sometimes not. And the Sankofa from Ghana is a reminder when you use memory to bring back what serves and to leave behind what does not. So the bird is looking behind, but it's not going to bring back what is not helpful or appropriate. It's going to bring back spots in time in Wordsworth's sense. So you mentioned some of your inner board of directors. Are any going to feel offended because you haven't mentioned them so far?
Well, Einstein is there. And,
of course. Yes, I had dreams 15 years ago of Einstein, and I was incredulous because why would he talk to a scientific ignoramus like me? And my Einstein, who I think was actually cast by my inner production crew, I don't think it was the spirit of Einstein, but my Einstein said, look, dreaming is the secret of time travel, which is going to prove to be more powerful and more dangerous than anything else. And I did a lot of dreaming, even though it wasn't called dreaming. And dreaming will be on the leading edge of science in the 21st century. And so that made sense. He showed me a synchronicity machine. He showed me how synchronicity is the result of bundles. They look like piñatas at the end of a big sort of tilt-a-wheel thing in a fairground. He showed me that how synchronicity comes about when these bundles, these probability bundles, are thrown from another world into this one, and the contents pop up all over the place across space and time, and people see they're related. And they don't understand this because they don't know that it was the cast of a single hand in a world beyond this one. So I found my Einstein good value. I wouldn't say that he's a member of my inner board of directors. I wouldn't be that, you know, I wouldn't be that assumptive. But I did find him good value and humorous too, which is essential.
Well, there are quite a number of people that I'm not sure. I don't think they're on my board, but they're certainly important to me in this book. And one is E.O. Wilson, the biologist who champions the idea of biophilia, human love of living things. And I also use that, I believe there's a dream biophilia, and that is that everything in the dream is alive. And this very much confirms the vision that Wordsworth attained, as described in Tintern Abbey, and then lost. And I think that's an important piece, too, that we can have these moments of tremendous insight and recognition in our dreams, and then we fall away from them. At least that's my problem, Robert. Maybe you never have, but I do all the time. So
you're saying that you find that there's a gap, there's a gap between what you're doing in dreaming and what you could do in waking life. Is that part of it?
I think there's kind of a dialogue between my powers of abstraction and analysis on the one hand, and this state where we are freed from that kind of thinking, and simply end up feeling so deeply the moment and the connection between all things. And those two are both.
I don't know that at this point of my life, having done a lot of dreaming and recorded so much for so many decades, I'm a little bit older than you, Roger. I'm glad. I'm still a bit older than just about everybody these days. But I don't feel that fundamental tension. I feel that there are two, let's say, currents in the relations between my dream world and my mortal life. A dream acquaintance of mine the other day referred to waking life as mortal life. Isn't that interesting? Think about what that implies.
That is so beautiful, yes.
When you return to mortal life, you and I can understand that, I think. I don't know that I find a fundamental tension. I find, you know, a contrast. I mean, the dream world has its own life. I do things there, have adventures there that I don't expect will ever be played out in ordinary reality and don't even necessarily have to be applied. On the other hand, things that I'm doing and people are doing with me in the dream world can be exported to waking life, and the energy can be brought through. Specific research assignments can be served. I mean, like Jung, I can say that I haven't done any significant work in my life that has not been inspired and promoted by dreams. I mean, that I'm paraphrasing very loosely from memory dreams reflections, but all of my best work for most of my life has been inspired and often guided in specific ways by my dreams. So I'm forever doing research. I'm forever dreaming in languages that I do not know much or hardly any, and the linguistic prompts are fascinating. I mean, they need all sorts of sources. So I'm constantly, I would say, excited by dreams. My take from any particular idea isn't necessarily that great. I make a point of not trying to control my dreams. Of course, I spend a lot of time as a teacher guiding people to imaginal locations, but then releasing the guidance so that they're not controlled by it, so that they're in a real setting with its own spontaneous possibilities. All right, we must pause for another break. What an interesting conversation. We're talking to Roger Kamenetz about his book, which will soon be available, Seeing into the Life of Things. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. Back after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination.
These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
We're back with Roger Kamenetz. This is Robert Noss. Way of the Dreamer is the show. Go to my website, mossdreams.com, and look for Roger's books, The History of Last Night's Dream, and the new one, Seeing into the Life of Things. Roger, our last exchange, when you mentioned biophilia and all of that, made me want to raise a topic which is of great current interest to me. I should preface this by saying I have a great gravitation towards the Victorians. The Victorian, the intellectuals, the psychic researchers, the poets, the characters of the Victorian into Edwardian era. Of course, one of those is William Butler Yeats. And another of those is Fred Myers, Frederick Myers, who gave us terms like telepathy, who was a poet and an intellectual. Another of those was W.T. Stead, a great psychic researcher and journalist. And, you know, they're in a period when faith is breaking down and science is coming on strong, but what about spirit? What about interesting questions like the soul and what happens after death? And a lot of people are looking into that. Now, one of the people who looked into all that was a man called Edward Taylor. He's raised as a Quaker. His father owned a brass foundry. He grew up in the heat and dust of the brass foundry, even though he's the boss's son. He became a self-educated scholar. Quakers couldn't go to university in England in those days, so he taught himself by reading. He read voraciously. Became an armchair anthropologist and the first professor of anthropology at Oxford. And I find the details of his life quite intriguing. Anyway, he gave us two ideas in a huge book called Primitive Culture, published in 1871. Number one, he said, the idea of the soul and its survival of death is derived from dreams. Primitive savages. Use the language of his day, thought that what happened in dreams was for real and that their souls were encountering other souls, including those of the dead, and then coming back to the body. They concluded from that there is a soul and there is an afterlife. So dreaming is the root of religion, since all religions require an afterlife. I'm paraphrasing. The other thing, this is why I raised him now, although that's relevant to what we're talking about. The other reason I raised Edward Taylor now, Sir Edward as he became, he also said that it is characteristic of savages in primitive society to think that spirits inhabit everything. In other words, that everything is alive. So he called this animism. This is where we get the first coherent at-length statement of animism. And although I rather like to celebrate Sir Edward, because despite his period colonialist language, he was onto a couple of important things. What I really want to say was that by my observation, animism is vibrantly on the rise again. It became very disreputable in anthropology as a profession to refer to animism or any of this. It was considered to be part of the infection of anthropology by Darwinism and evolutionary theories and so on. Right. But I find a lot of my friends today are proudly calling themselves animist, by which they mean they see that everything's alive, everything deserves to be respected. And to go indigenous again for a moment, as Aborigines would say, everything is talking to us. Everything is speaking to us.
Right.
So do you feel that you are, you might not like the word, I have ambivalence about it, but would you call yourself, is being a biophiliac, being an animist, are they synonyms, or is there something different?
It's different. The other figure that I bring into the book, Owen Barfield, who was one of the Oxford English.
Oh, yes, one of the English.
And he emphasized the concept of participation, which he took from an early anthropologist Franz Boas, and the notion of it is, I mean, this is what I would emphasize, just like in the passage we were describing, the brief passage about the Virginia day flower, the name I did not know at the time, but that was the blue flower, that we bring things to life through our participating them. It's an archaic use of the verb. We participate the blue flower. We participate the images in our dreams of our fathers or mothers who appear. We bring them to life through the power of imagination and deep feeling. And in that encounter, the I and the other break down, and it's all one. There's a merger there. And so are we, and this, you know, you know, the Germans have this phrase, Eingefühling, that I discussed, which means basically feeling into. When we feel into something, this got translated in 1906, I believe, by an American psychologist as empathy. That's where the word empathy originates. So if I feel into the things and the people around me and I make this conscious effort to do so, you know, remember the teacher in my dreams said, don't be afraid to make everything you say a prayer, but also don't be afraid to make everything you see and sense and feel alive. And, you know, we live in a time when the opposite is happening, where people are canceling each other and making them less alive through their gaze and through their encounters. So here's the counter to that, too. And when I do that, when I bring that energy, then there are no dead things. And so you could call me an animist, but it's not a religion. It's an experience. It's how I feel it and how I engage it. And this is where I think dreams are helping us so much, because they give us that experience directly. We feel the, you know, death does, is no barrier. The thingness of a thing is no barrier. It still can come alive for us. Animals, we can engage with animals and come close to them, even though in waking life that might be... it's terrifying when a lion breathes on you, as it did on one of my clients' dreams. So we can feel our world. We can feel our world. We can feel into it, which is this aesthetic experience, too, that poets know. You know that Yeats poem where there's a coat on a coat rack is the most terrifying thing he ever saw? You know, it's like...
A tattered coat upon a stick and less soul... clap its hands and sing, and louder things.
Yeah.
I grew up able to recite a lot of him since I was a boy. And
but
so Yeats was part of my inner board of advisors, and came through very vibrantly when I was writing my book, The Dreamer's Book of the Dead, and I write about it very openly.
Well, he has another poem where he basically describes his most terrifying moment, and I believe it's a piece of clothing on a coat rack that's maybe being moved about. So this way in which we can participate the world, engage the world, you can call it animism, but it's not from a belief, it's from an experience. That's the distinction, I think. And it's something we have to bring to our experience and can learn to do from our dreams. So I think we're on the same page there.
I love your range of references. I was, several things were starred in my mind. I mean, from the literature of the world as you spoke. One is Rilke, and we both like Rilke too. Rilke said, looking ripens things. Looking ripens things.
Oh, wow. Oh, I wish I'd known that when I wrote the book. Looking ripens things.
Yeah, you mentioned Franz Boas. I mean, I'm not an anthropologist by training, but I mean, not only reading tons of anthropology, but looking at the whole, you know, progression of anthropology through its different schools and different individuals. Anyway, on Boas, who was a fascinating character, one of his protégés was Waldemar Bogoris, a Jew from the western, what is now western Ukraine, who was sent as a political prisoner, a revolutionary, to Siberia under the Tsars. He got to know the Chukchi very well, and his account of the Chukchi is huge, is fascinating. And he quotes the Chukchi elders saying, the lamp is alive, not just the elk is alive, the whale is alive, the reindeer is alive, the lamp is alive. I mean, you've got, anyway, an absolutely version of animism published by Bogoris between 1904 and 1910. the lamp, pointing at the white man's lamp. The lamp is alive too. All right, we must pause for our last break, and then we'll just be back to say thank you and dream on. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. Our wonderful guest is Roger Caminetz. You can find him online, and I've been recommending his books, and we'll go on doing so.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
I love talking to someone who loves reading as much as I do, makes good use of it and can hold it and quote it. Roger, you are a wonderful writer, a wonderful reader, wonderful teacher of our need to see in a fresh and also ancient and primal way. Thank you so much for all you've shared.
Thank you, Robert. You bring out the best in me. I appreciate talking with you.
All right. May our best dreams come true, and to everybody, may your best dreams come true, and may you remember them.